This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
So it's minutes before airtime yesterday on Media Buzz, and my producer tells me that we may have to do a show and go, which is TV business lingo for taking some live pictures, doing a brief description of the scene, and then getting out and moving back to your regular programming. And usually it's the start of a press conference or the president getting off a plane, and you just kind of telling viewers that, hey, this is happening live now, and you go back to whatever you're going to discuss. And the subject was baby formula, the baby formula crisis, which, as you know, I think is a huge and largely avoidable crisis. This shortage is nuts. And the formula, the pictures were not exactly very exciting. It's the Indianapolis airport, and they hadn't even started unloading it from the plane, the formula coming in from Germany. So look, I'm glad that President Biden has invoked the Defense Production Act to force some of these other companies to make the ingredients that go into formula. And I'm glad that, he's taken steps to import some of this stuff. This came from Germany. And, you know, if it wasn't for the crazy rules, because I did say on the air that Biden's playing catch up here. This was an avoidable crisis. These rules that limit the U.S. from importing formula that's sold throughout Europe from places like Germany, imported from Canada, that is what has contributed to this crisis. So the fact that it's being waived now, we shouldn't have these rules in the first place, as long as it can pass a basic safety test. Another thing, and this is not the president's fault, this has gone on for centuries, but I guess it was a couple days ago, Congress gave final approval to the bill the president had requested, $40 billion in aid to Ukraine, much of that military aid, and the figure actually higher than the president originally had requested. So 11 Republican senators voted against it. Otherwise, it had bipartisan support. So some aide who was said to be going there anyway had to carry the bill on a plane, go halfway around the world, and give it to Biden so he could immediately sign it and it would take effect and enable U.S. military to start shipping these weapons there, plus the humanitarian assistance. And I'm thinking, what is this? The carrier pigeon era? You know, we live in an age where people DM each other, where we use our phones or computers to send each other images, documents. You can copy them. You can make them into a PDF file, and you can get it 5 seconds later. Why can't Congress change a rule or a law, whatever the hell it is, that says, no, you don't have to fly the document around the globe at some expense. You can just take a picture of the bill that Congress has passed and somebody authorizes it and the president signs that. Seriously, what is this? It's nuts. Okay, sports writing you may think is a pretty easy job. It seems like a fun job. I would agree. But man, it can also be dangerous, especially if you're covering golf. ESPN anchor Sage Steele. This is really bad stuff. Struck in the head by an errant tee shot at the PGA Championship, had to be taken to a local hospital in Tulsa. This is a couple of days ago. John Rahm was the golfer. As soon as he hooked the shot wide left, it hit Steele at what was said to be 181 miles an hour. One witness told the local news outlet they saw her on the ground holding her mouth, nose, chin area, her hands covered in blood. Like, wow, she's just there to do her job. Since that report, she's gotten out of the hospital. She's gone home. She's going to recover from, you know, what could have been a life-threatening incident. She's not going to go back to the PGA Championship. She had been in the news because she sued the Disney-owned ESPN for allegedly keeping her off the network after she criticized the company's vaccine requirements. Well, that's one form of controversy. But wow, you think I mean, even in baseball, you know, a lot of times somebody can't catch the foul, but probably it takes a little bit longer to get there. You have time to duck or, you know, put your hands up. I guess she didn't have time to do that. Also, going back to the president's trip in Asia, hasn't really made much news except for this. Two Secret Service employees have basically been kicked off the trip. They were involved in conduct that ended in a confrontation with South Korean citizens and have been booted back to the U.S. This is hardly the first instance of Secret Service agents behaving badly overseas. Spokesman for the service said that the incidents occurred while they were not on duty, and it may constitute a potential policy violation. They've been put on leave. They'd gone out to dinner with a group. Then they went bar hopping. All right, so now they're sloshed. Went back to their hotel in the taxi. One of the employees went to his room. The other got into an argument with the taxi driver and two Korean citizens who were apparently trying to enter the same taxi. It's a classic thing that happens in Manhattan every day. Hotel security got involved. Police were summoned about a possible assault. The official said no one was arrested or detained, despite earlier accounts to that effect. But they were sent back to the U.S. Agents behaving badly, I guess. All right, let me get out of business here with story number one. Huge piece in the New York Times yesterday, top of the front page, about Republicans who are in office, Republican legislators in states, who have used the power of their office to either try to discredit or overturn the results of the 2020 election. This is the new media focus now that the GOP primaries season is underway and we're seeing who gets elected. So, according to a review of state-by-state voting records, et cetera, by the Times, and there are all kinds of graphs and charts, 44% of Republican legislators in the nine states, the nine key battleground states where all presidential races are decided, have actually argued that there was widespread fraud in the states that were carried by Biden. The Times analysis, and here we get to the it's all Trump's fault, exposes how deeply rooted lies and misinformation about Trump's defeat have become in state legislatures. Well, you know, it is. Trump talks about this like every day. He's writing a book about it. In sum, the false view that the election was stolen, either by fraud or as a result of some pandemic-related changes to the process, is now widely accepted as fact among Republican lawmakers. These fictions, just reading from the Times piece, folks, about rigged elections and widespread fraud provided the foundation for new laws that make it harder to vote and easier to insert partisanship in the vote count. Three states, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, state lawmakers have successfully pushed for investigations that sowed doubt about what was going on. And so, you know, that's a pretty big chunk of these legislatures, and it really matters because in the GOP-controlled legislatures, it seems to me that, you know, this could have serious consequences for 2024. This is interesting. I guess this is a brief interview because not much of it is quoted. In an interview with the Times, Trump acknowledged that in deciding whom to endorse in state legislative races, he is looking for candidates who want state legislatures to have a say in naming presidential electors, a position that could let politicians short-circuit the democratic process. And I have to pause here and say, I mean, of all the things that are going on, mail-in ballots and restrictions on voting, this is the one that I think is most dangerous. Because potentially, and given the rhetoric of some of these people about what should have been done in 2020 or what they would do in 2024, you could override the popular vote. Now, I don't see any argument for politicians who have their own interests in stake. They support one candidate or another, unless serious fraud can be proven, which it was not in 2020, unless the state, the vote tally was so close that there has to be a recount or an audit, you know, Florida 2000, you name it. Why on earth would you set aside that the people of, you name it, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Michigan, and let a bunch of politicians decide? I mean, it's the ultimate backroom deal. It says to the voters, we don't care who you wanted. We're going to go with the alternate slate of Trump electors or somebody else. And so it seems to me to be indefensible. And yet, many of them are openly talking about doing just that. Now, in a related story, the Washington Post weighs in. The guy who is really being targeted now by the press is Doug Mastriano. He is the Republican nominee now for governor of Pennsylvania. And he has openly said that he wants to give state lawmakers a role. He wants to decertify voting machines in certain areas. He does not accept the results of the 2020 election in Pennsylvania. And he says all this openly. And that's what he ran on. And he will be running against Democrat John Fetterman, the guy, the big guy who goes around in a hoodie and who had a minor stroke before primary night. So obviously Mastriano now under a lot of scrutiny. Washington Post has a piece saying 2 decades earlier, he warned in his master's thesis that the U.S. was vulnerable to a left-wing Hitlerian putsch that would begin the dismantling of the U.S. military and end with the destruction of the country's democracy. Now, this is a long time ago, but it's interesting nonetheless. The thesis was written in 2001. He was a major at the Air Force's Air Command and Staff College. And this thesis is unusual for its doomsaying and often fearful point of view. The Washington Post piece goes on to say that it's posted on an official DOD website. He got a master's, as I mentioned. He adopts the point of view, as he's telling a little story here, of a colonel who's living in 2018, 17 years into the future, and has taken refuge in an isolated cavern in a forest. The military's collapse, in his telling, allowed a left-wing leader obsessed with political correctness and backed militarily by the UN and the European Union to rise to power in a struggle that led to the deaths of millions of Americans. This is dark stuff, ladies and gentlemen. Here is a quote. Domestically, life was bleak with a rampant drug culture, hedonism, and a plethora of alternate regions dominating American youth, alternate religions, I should say. We were a people without vision or direction. Ultimately, he concluded the U.S. military was the only institution to prevent the destruction of the Republic. Now, the document also has other things that people in Pennsylvania or the country may find interesting. It displays, again, this is according to the Post piece, a disgust for anyone who doesn't hold his view that homosexuality is a form of aberrant sexual conduct and is a kind of a harbinger of things to come, where Mastriano is blaming, you know, January 6th and rampant fraud for Trump's defeat. Now, the nominee did not comment on the story, but in a recent interview with Steve Bannon for his podcast, Mastriano said his 30 years of military service and security clearances proved that he did not hold extreme views. And so I'm just going to call them out, he says. I'm not going to stand aside and let them create a narrative about me.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day. Featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
This is a nice segue into looking at the January 6th investigation and upcoming hearings. I had radio host Hugh Hewitt on the show yesterday, and he was saying that, you know, while the political and journalistic class is ultimately transfixed by January 6th, which, you know, I have to say every time I mention it, was an absolute tragedy, a very dark day in our history, given the violence that broke out in an attempt to stop Joe Biden from being certified as president. He said, when these hearings start on TV, the ratings are going to be, he said, lower than when he had an MSNBC show. He said they will be zero. Now, they're not going to be zero, but that's an interesting question. He says people in America are profoundly uninterested in this investigation. They view it as partisan. That's his point of view. But this brings me to Rudy, because Rudy Giuliani, who obviously was the point man for so many of those crucial weeks when all those lawsuits were being filed and all the efforts were being made to convince the public that no, we need more investigations, more recounts. Donald Trump did not lose. Joe Biden could not possibly have won. Trump won 75 million votes, therefore he must have won, except Biden is now widely agreed by people who don't have an axe to grind, won 81 million votes. So after a lot of back and forth, Rudy has done a 9-hour personal interview with the House January 6th committee. I love this detail. He took a break in the middle of it to host his afternoon radio show for an hour up in New York. So I'll be right back. And then he starts the show and then he goes back. Now, he was going to do it. Then he backed out. Then he was making demands. We don't know what he told the committee. I assume we'll eventually find out. This was first reported by CNN. He negotiated with the panel for months. And, you know, as a former U.S. attorney, as a former associate attorney general, both jobs on which I covered him, you know, a zillion years ago, he finally did reach an agreement to talk about matters other than his direct conversations with Donald Trump, which he argued were covered by attorney-client privilege. It's not a crazy thing to say, but I guess he was asked about a lot of his own actions. He was going to be interviewed earlier in May. He pulled out. They wouldn't let him record the session. He finally dropped that demand after the panel said it would use enforcement options, which would mean, you know, refer him to the Justice Department for criminal contempt. I mean, the last thing in the world Rudy Giuliani wants is to be referred to his old department for not cooperating with, he may view it as politically illegitimate, but a congressional investigation. Okay, let me move on to the unbelievably complicated, but I'll try to boil it down, number three. And I'm basing this in part, I've read all the pieces. I'm going to lead off with a piece by Andy McCarthy in National Review, and it has to do with this Michael Sussman trial. And let me pause here and say, I get it. I don't think 98% of Americans know who Michael Sussman is. This is the trial being prosecuted by that special counsel, John Durham, a U.S. attorney who was named by Bill Barr and has been investigating for a long time, finally ended up bringing this one charge against Michael Sussman, who had worked with the Hillary Clinton campaign. This is about the origins of Russiagate. And the reason I'm going to go into it is there actually is a very strong angle here involving the media, the FBI, and Hillary Clinton herself. The gist of it, before I go into the details, is that Michael Sussman has been indicted for lying to the FBI, for not being straight with the Bureau about the fact that he was bringing information about this supposed tie between Donald Trump and some foreign bank that was supposed to lend credence to the notion that he was colluding, cooperating, choose your verb, with Russia, Russia, Russia. But in fact, he was working with the Clinton campaign. So the prosecutors decided to put on the stand Robbie Mook. Robbie Mook was the campaign manager for Hillary back in 2016. And that opened the door to something that the Hillary Clinton campaign, or Hillary Clinton herself, since there is no more campaign, did not want the jury to see. So it may have backfired. So Mook goes up there and he testifies, and this is fascinating, that Hillary Clinton herself, I'm not shocked, but it's nevertheless interesting, approved a proposal from her campaign to leak this, what he describes as a back channel smear, to the media. Now remember, Hillary Clinton couldn't stand the press. She was always blaming the New York Times for making too much of her private server. She didn't like talking to reporters. She had a very testy relationship with journalists during that presidential campaign. But as with lots of politicians who publicly badmouth the media, she wasn't above using the media, if she could, to try to get something out. So she approves this leak. And that's where the door got open. So here we have Robbie Mook saying, yeah, Hillary approved it. We were going to leak it to the press. So why do Sussman's lawyers do that? It was done for what Andy McCarthy thinks is a very shaky defense. Sussman, and by the way, I think because it's so complicated and this is a D.C. jury, I think even though, in my view, he clearly did lie to the FBI, I'm not confident at all he's going to be convicted. But that's not the main point here. The main point is this. He wanted to challenge the allegation that he represented the Clinton campaign because that's where the alleged lie comes in. And he's entitled to the presumption of innocence. But he can't because the evidence is overwhelming. He was billing his time to the Clinton campaign. So here he goes to, he wants to go to the FBI and say, you know what? And he actually says in his interview with the FBI, I'm not here on behalf of any client or campaign. I'm just here as an American citizen. I have information I think you should know about Donald Trump and this Alpha Bank. Well, that wasn't true, but he wants to be able to say it's true, so he now can't deny that, especially with Robbie Mook's testimony. So he's trying to get off, and he's trying to convince the Bureau that if he brought the information, the whole point of bringing this to the New York Times was to get the New York Times to do a story on this, and then they thought the Times would say the FBI is investigating, because a lot of stories are just that. You don't even know what it is, but the fact that there is a federal law enforcement investigation gives it a certain gravitas. So Sussman betrayed the campaign out of personal loyalty to the FBI, yada, yada, yada. Not really buying this. Because he wasn't really representing the campaign, except he billed the campaign for the time that he spent talking to the FBI. Okay. And of course, remember, the Clinton campaign didn't trust the FBI. Hillary Clinton was furious with Jim Comey for the press conference he held when he didn't charge her, but then, trashed her at this news conference about the private server and so forth. So here is the highest official in the Clinton campaign that the campaign actually took this stuff to the FBI. But then comes the New York Times. What happens is the Times doesn't go along. The Times reporters look at it and they say, we're not convinced there's a story here. And then you get into this horse trading. Well, if you do the story, we'll give you something that we have. And they gave some stuff saying, look, they were very skeptical. The FBI officials told the New York Times reporters they were skeptical of this allegation. So what does the Times turn around and do? The Times, to its credit, doesn't run the spoon-fed story from the Hillary campaign, writes a story saying, according to sources, the FBI has been asked to investigate this Donald Trump-Russia tie, but is very skeptical of it. Exactly the opposite of what the Hillary Clinton campaign wanted in its attempt to use a leak to try to get publicity that, of course, everybody would then pick up, saying Donald Trump is further evidence of his collusion with Russia. So I hope I didn't make that too complicated. It's a complicated story, but I think the media angle is worth exploring. Number four, Ginny Thomas back in the news. The Washington Post broke this story. She very much in the news because of her efforts as a conservative activist in her own right, and was doing that before she married Clarence Thomas, to work the White House, President Trump himself, and others in the conservative network to try to say that the election was stolen and it should be overturned. Well, new information now about Ginny Thomas. We now know that she twice lobbied the Speaker of the Arizona House and another GOP lawmaker in Arizona to try to reverse Biden's popular vote victory in that crucial state and deliver it to Trump. So think about this for a minute. This is exactly what I was talking about earlier. Get the state legislators to intervene, overturn, and go with an alternate slate of elections, and boom, Arizona is gone. Now, it so happens these emails are written to two people. The Republican Speaker of the House, whose name is Russell Bowers, and Shauna Bolick, Republican state rep, whose husband, Clint Bolick, once worked with Justice Thomas and now is on the Arizona Supreme Court. He was a conservative activist for many years. So the emails come as Trump and his allies came, I should say, while they were trying to overturn his defeats in all these battleground states. Arizona was among them. Remember, it was very close, and Fox called it, and it was 10,000 margin, so forth and so on. So, Ginny Thomas writes, and there is an email copy of this, do your constitutional duty. This was as Trump was refusing to concede. She wrote this on November 9th. So it's half dozen days after the election. Then on December 13th, she contacted the lawmakers again. The nation's eyes are on you now. Please consider what will happen to the nation we all love if you do not stand up and lead. And so after she sent the first round of emails, but not the second round, Trump and Rudy more directly pressured Bowers, the speaker. They called him and said, you got to have the state legislature step in and choose Arizona's electors. So this was a dry run for what many Democrats fear will happen in 2024. In a statement to the Arizona Republic, spokesman for Bowers said he never saw Thomas's email. He was getting deluged with emails. Bolick, who did not respond to requests for comment, and is now running to become Arizona's Secretary of State on a platform of restoring election integrity. Well, you know what that means. She was more of an ally. She thanked Jeannie Thomas for reaching out, writing that she hoped you and Clarence are doing great. She would go on to urge Congress to throw out Arizona's presidential election results and award the Electoral College votes to Trump. Now, on Friday, a lawyer for the Thomases told the New York Times that Jeannie Thomas did not write the letter and had no input in the content, but rather merely signed her name to a pre-written form letter that was signed by thousands of citizens. Well, that may be true, and she's just one person signing on, but she's not just one person. She's a very prominent conservative actress who happens to be married to a Supreme Court justice, and I think this makes it, I mean, Clarence Thomas has made clear he's going to do what he wants to do, but the fact that she was sort of taking these active steps, I think, makes it harder for him not to recuse himself in any future case involving this, but obviously justices decide what they are going to do. But also, you know, the reason that she's able to reach these people with the emails is they know who she is. They know the family. So she's not just one person who signed it. She's a very prominent person who is very determined to do what she could to try to reverse the election results.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
And finally, story number five. You've probably heard from now the news about Saturday Night Live. This was leaked a day before the season finale over the weekend to Variety and I think Deadline. A bunch of talented people leaving the show all as it ends its 47th season. How can Saturday Night Live be 47 years old? Must make me old. I used to stay up and watch it until 1 in the morning. So you have Adi Bryant, Kyle Mooney, Kate McKinnon, who I just think is a brilliant, I mean, obviously, she's a liberal and, you know, she's done all these great impersonations. I think she's a brilliant comedian. And Pete Davidson, who I didn't really know who he was when he joined SNL. And he was sort of the new kid on the block. Somehow he has become huge. I mean, some of it is Kim Kardashian. Some of it is this cult following he has. I don't totally tap into his sense of humor, but I'm probably outside the demo that would do that anyway. All of them leaving, that's a big fat hole for Lorne Michaels and SNL. Now, if you go through the history of SNL, you find there have been other seasons when a number of talented people at once have left, and people say, oh, we'll never be the same, and somehow they have managed over the years to recruit new talent. But I don't think SNL had the greatest season. I mean, they missed Donald Trump. Alec Baldwin probably misses Donald Trump. Although the new guy who does Trump does technically a much better impersonation than the Alec Baldwin caricature. And so for fans of Pete Davidson, certainly, who now spilling out his guts about how traumatic this is for him and how hard it is to leave. But look, I mean, he's such a name now, he could probably go on to do just about anything. For fans of Kate McKinnon, you know, there is, you know, if you have a 10-year run there, as Davidson did. I mean, that's a long tenure by SNL standards because it's a crazy life. I mean, you work crazy hours, you stay up all night the night before with rehearsals and everything. But if you can go on to movies and, you know, Netflix series and other projects, generally you sense that there's a moment when you can do it, when you're still hot. You don't want to wait until, you know, they run you out of there, right? You want to do it when you still are considered, you know, an up-and-coming star. So we'll see who they recruit for next time. But then, you know, it takes time for these other people to become known. I mean, there was a time when you could just reach out and say, okay, I'm going to have Eddie Murphy, or I'm going to have, you know, who are some of the other great comedians of the age? I'm going to get Adam Sandler. I'm going to get Dana Carvey, you know, but the exposure is invaluable, particularly if you're in the comedian business. And SNL remains a great platform. Again, I think it's kind of had an off season. Maybe we're not all as addicted to politics as we were. You know, some of the jokes seem predictable to me, but you know, what do people do? They watch clips now, and it's a very important moneymaker for NBC because it has a young demographic, particularly if you watch clips online. Well, that's what we all do these days. I mean, obviously they would prefer to people stay up on Saturday night and, you know, have some beers and popcorn and watch the show live. But I'm told the net is a place where you can make a lot of money. And so suddenly the franchise, and you know, when Saturday Night Live started in, what was it, 1976, I think, there was no internet. You either watched it on TV or you didn't see it. It was appointment television. Well, now we're all used to having everything whenever we want to see it, as soon as we want to see it, just press the button. But you still got to fly the bill around the world for Joe Biden to sign it. Hey, thanks for coming along for the ride. Hope you had a good weekend. If you didn't get a chance to see Media Buzz, we covered a lot of stories. Disinformation board, Buffalo shooting fallout, Elon Musk, the latest on Elon, and the dirty tricks. And I talked about this on Friday, the dirty tricks that he predicted. Just coincidental, I'm sure, that suddenly a six-year-old sexual assault allegation by a staffer gets resurrected. The timing, yeah, I'm sure, had nothing to do with the fact that he himself said that he would be, people would be coming after him after he said, you know what, I used to love the Democrats, I'm fed up with the Democratic Party, I'm voting Republican. He knew he had a target on his back, and probably there'll be more of it. Did SpaceX and Musk reach a settlement with the staffer who makes these allegations, which he denies, who's unnamed, and a friend was quoted anonymously by Insider? They did pay her $250,000 to go away. As I said on the show, if you like Elon Musk, you say, well, you know, that's just a rounding error for him to avoid any bad publicity. If you don't like Elon Musk, you say, you know, it was hush money. What he did was buy her silence. So Charlie Gasparino called it a soap opera, and that's why I have a daily Elon episode. And the soap opera goes on. Hey, we'll see you all tomorrow with more BuzzFeed.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.